dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who have done more to chronicle and help the rest of us understand the nature of that war for the free world, that multi-generational struggle. Indeed, as one of the men he profiled, Ronald Reagan, used to say, every generation must fight an existential fight for freedom, is our guest for this entire hour. I'm very pleased to say Dr. Paul Kenger, a best-selling historian and professor at Grove City College, is with us to talk about this world we're in, the war for the free world, how it's being waged, and what we need to do to ensure we prevail in it. And I'm very grateful to him for providing us this kind of opportunity to really drill down on many subjects. Paul, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Frank. Thanks.
Well, I want to start, I guess, by taking advantage of your expertise and deep knowledge by asking you to address a topic that weighs on me heavily, and that is the state of the world at the moment and whether we're witnessing, perhaps irreversibly, the end of Pax Americana, an arrangement that has served us, I think, and many, many others very well over a long period of time. Is that what's going on here, Paul? And if there is, in fact, now a vacuum, who's filling it and what are the implications?
Yeah, I think you're right, Frank, and it's at the least a temporary abandonment of it under Barack Obama. And you're right. You pose the question very well. Is it irreversible? And I think it probably is. But you know, you have people like Lech Walesa out there in the world, and you know, begging the United States for leadership. And in fact, I've got Walesa's quote in front of me here. He says, "The point is not in having the states fix the problems for us or fight somewhere. The state should organize us, encourage us, and offer us programs, while we, the world, should do the rest. This is the kind of leadership is needed." And Lech Walesa continued, "Either you want to be a superpower and guide us, or you should give the superpower to Poland, right? And we will know what to do with it." And you know, I kind of chuckle there a little bit, and not in any way to insult Poland or our Polish friends, but there you see the very essence of leadership, right? You have someone who's willing to come forward and say, "Well, then give it to us. We'll take it." There's that willingness, that desire, and for him to think of Poland in that way is quite inspiring. But with Barack Obama, you have a very deliberate abandonment of leadership in the world. And when he talked about a fundamental transformation, Frank, you know, people think, well, he meant America and the things that we do domestically. It wasn't just that. I mean, it applies to foreign policy as well. And I think people have missed it when they haven't applied Obama's ideas of fundamental transformation outside of our borders as well as inside of our borders. He was really telling us a lot there about where he's going and where he sees the U.S. position in the world.
Yeah. You know, we'll be touching upon that theme of fundamental transformation, I'm sure, throughout the program, Paul. But just staying with your observation about Lech Walesa and Poland, you know, what's so striking about that, of course, is that that is a country. Don Rumsfeld famously thought of it as New Europe, a country that rather much more recently than we has experienced what the, you know, wages of inattention to totalitarianism can be like. And they don't want to go back there, that's for sure. And I know among the other entrants in the competition to fill the vacuum that Barack Obama has created, of course, is the nation that has brought the Poles great grief over many years, namely their neighbors to the east, Russia. Talk a little bit, Paul, about your sort of sense of where Vladimir Putin is at the moment. We're seeing new sanctions being imposed by the U.S. on Russia for its continuing threats to Ukraine. Are the Poles right to be concerned, and shouldn't we be as well?
Yeah, yes, they are. And I did an interview a few weeks ago with a Polish publication, and the journalist ended the questions by saying, Professor, do you think Poland is next? And what he meant by that was we were talking about the Ukraine and the Crimea. And she was worried, and Poles are worried, that Russia is next going to go into Poland, and that the United States is not going to do anything about it whatsoever. And, you know, regardless of whether or not Poland is a member of NATO, they have that fear that Obama has so abandoned the U.S. leadership role in the world, and also Poland in the process. And this goes back to September 17, 2009. I remember that date very well because September 17, 2009, which was the day that Barack Obama announced the canceling of the joint U.S. missile shield with Poland and the Czech Republic, that was the 70th anniversary to the exact date, September 17, 1939, when the Soviet Red Army invaded Poland in compliance with the Hitler-Stalin Pact.
Paul, let me just ask you, is there any possibility that that was purely coincidental?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, at the time I thought, boy, what idiots we have around our current president, that no one would have said to him, Mr. President, I know you want to cancel this, but you need to be attentive to dates. I know you couldn't possibly know this, but this is the 70th anniversary of the day that Stalin's Red Army invaded Poland. So you can't do it on this date. And then Obama said, oh, gee, okay, I got it. Okay, let's not do it on that date. But looking back, I have here, too, Polish friends who believe that was absolutely intentional, that they chose the 70th anniversary as a slap in the face to Poland.
And as a gesture sucking up to the Russians, with whom they've been frantically, as a cornerstone of their foreign policy, trying to effect a reset. Paul, let me switch gears, because I do want to touch on a couple of other entrants, as I say, in this competition to fill the vacuum. China has become vastly more aggressive of late. Again, knowing, as you do, these epic trends in history, do you believe that there's no relation between their sense that the United States is receding or even a waning power and their opportunities for asserting themselves even aggressively against our friends and allies and interests in the Western Pacific and beyond?
Yeah, it's all related. No question about it. I mean, countries behave this way when they perceive a leadership vacuum in the world. You know, here, too, to give you yet another anniversary, Frank, I mean, here we are on the verge of August 2014, 100 years after August 1914, when war broke out, you know, throughout the world, well, throughout Europe, leading to World War One. We just celebrated the 100th anniversary of the day when Gavrilo Princip pulled the trigger and killed the Austrian Archduke and his wife, and that set off a series of events where you soon had Serbia, Russia, Austria-Hungary, Germany, and then eventually France and Britain all in war by the end of this summer, 100 years ago. And World War One was a classic example of a receding vacuum of power in Europe. And in that case, it began with the Ottoman Empire, which had been there since 1389. As the Ottoman Empire started to recede, you had this vying of power with Russia, Austria-Hungary, Germany, all the different major powers in Europe and the major powers in the world. And you know, that's going on again right now. And with not just a receding of power, but a total abandonment of American power and the American position in the world by Obama, you're seeing the major actors of the world, the major powers, Russia and China in particular, stepping forth.
Paul, this is really where I want to go with our next block is talking about how this contrasts with previous presidencies and their conduct of international affairs and national security. And it's so telling. You know, I'm also reminded of another transitional period. Winston Churchill called it the gathering storm in the run-up to that second horrific global conflagration, World War II. And it seems to me, whether it's the vacuum of power that is, you know, encouraging, emboldening this kind of aggression, or whether it is simply the fact that we've got, at the moment, these various competing forces at work that seem so ominous, I think, to anybody looking at them with a modicum of clarity, as you do, that we must be concerned and we must be attentive to the lessons of history. We'll be back with more with Paul Kanger, the author of 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist, or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're having a very special conversation for this full hour with one of our time's preeminent historians, best-selling authors, and I think most, perspicacious observers of the contemporary scene. He is Dr. Paul Kenger of Grove City College, the author of numerous extraordinarily important books, including most recently 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative. Paul, I wanted to just segue from our previous conversation in which you really set out what's happening in the world at the moment and talk a little bit about your study of past presidencies and the contrast between this one and, say, that of Jimmy Carter, or we'll get to Ronald Reagan in a moment. But Carter had some of the same seeming naive or wishful thinking characterized policies up to a point. Is Carter the model for Barack Obama, or is Obama really in a class by himself?
Yeah, I mean, I think Obama is in a class by himself. With Carter, I mean, Carter's foreign policy was so disastrous. And for a while, Frank, I would tell people, well, yeah, Obama has been bad for foreign policy, but he still hasn't surpassed Carter. Well, I think we might be at that point now. And with Carter, there was a very troubling naivete. He didn't seem to realize when he was getting himself in trouble just how bad the Russians were. There was a misplaced trust in the good faith of the Russians. I mean, one of my favorite examples. You have this extraordinary image in June 1979, where Jimmy Carter literally hugs and kisses Leonid Brezhnev, right? And then 6 months after that, the Soviets are invading Afghanistan. And you know, that was around Christmas Day, December 25th, 26th, 27th, 1979. President Carter, this born-again Baptist from Georgia, is celebrating Christmas with the family with his family at the White House. And his advisors come in and say, "Mr. President, I have bad news for you. The Soviets just invaded Afghanistan." And then you know, the guy that you literally hugged and kissed 6 months ago is just betrayed.
Just
you.
Spat in your eye, indeed. We're visiting with Dr. Paul Kenger of Grove City College, the author of numerous extraordinarily interesting and insightful books, including a couple of my favorites. We'll be talking more about them momentarily. Dupes: How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century, and The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor. Staying with Carter for just a moment, Paul Kenger, was he one of the progressives who was manipulated by these progressive manipulating types in hostile places like the Kremlin during the day of Leonid Brezhnev?
Yeah, he was, and I think the Soviets realized in Carter's case they can act in a way where Carter would be completely surprised by how they acted. I think a lot of times in the case of Barack Obama, the Russians today think that they can act and simply get away with it. That the president is maybe not going to be surprised at all, but that he's just not going to do anything about it. With Carter, after that December 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, I remember reading years later, Frank, this was in the Reagan Library, and I saw they had this huge file of Reagan handwritten letters from over the years, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And this one would not have been available in 1979 or the 1980s, but Ronald Reagan wrote a letter to a friend, and he said there, "How disappointing is it that we have only now in President Carter somebody who after 3 or 4 years in the presidency has only now learned that the Russians can't be trusted." And what Reagan was referring to there was Carter had given an interview to Frank Reynolds of ABC. This was around, I want to say, January 4th, 5th, 10th, 1980, a few days after the Soviet invasion. And Carter made this horrible statement where he said, you know, the Russians have done more to change my opinion of them in the last 2 weeks than at any other time during my presidency. And that's when Ronald Reagan was inspired to say how sad it is and how tragic it is that we have a man in the presidency who only now has learned that the Russians can't be trusted.
Let's turn, Paul, to Reagan, because he subsequently got into this meme about trusting but verifying the Russians. But during his presidency, particularly the first term of his presidency, and for that matter, for many years before he became president, as you've chronicled in, among other places, your terrific book, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism, he was a man who, very much in contrast to Barack Obama, was about rebuilding American strength and using it, as he put it, to achieve a strategy of we win, they lose, namely the defeat of Soviet communism and ultimately of the state that enabled it. Talk a little bit about how that Reagan policy and posture and doctrine contrasts with the Obama doctrine of today.
Yeah, and in so many ways. I mean, peace through strength was Reagan's operating credo. And you've reminded me of that many times, Frank. And one of my favorite Reagan quotes, he said, it was obvious that if we were going to get anywhere with the Russians and persuading them to reduce arms, to cut missiles, whatever, we had to bargain with them from strength and not weakness. Here's an exact Reagan quote. If you were going to approach the Russians with a dove of peace in one hand, you had to have a sword in the other. And you know, Reagan understood that these guys respect strength, not weakness. And a Vladimir Putin, who looks at a Barack Obama, and Obama says through Dmitry Medvedev, you know, tell Vladimir Putin that I'll have more flexibility after the election. You know, Obama might think that the Russians are going to want to put their arm around him and say, boy, Barack, you're really a great guy. We really like you. But what somebody like Putin, an ex-KGB guy, thinks when he hears that is he thinks to himself, here's a sucker that I can roll. Here's somebody that I can exploit. Here's somebody that I could take advantage of. Sure, you might think we're a couple good fellow redistributionists and we'll get along just fine. But what you're telling me there, Barack, is that I can act unimpeded. You're not going to stop me. Reagan, right there, if Reagan was around today, if our old friend Frank Bill Clark was around today and was advising Bill Clark, he would have said, this is Russian. This is how a Vladimir Putin acts.
Right. But let me just ask you, Paul, this is such an important point. And to what extent do you think this is something that is simply haplessness or incompetence on Barack Obama's part? And alternatively, do you think that it might have something to do with the mentoring he received from a communist you've profiled, Frank Marshall Davis, and a kind of radical anti-Americanism that he imbibed throughout his youth and young adulthood, right on through, you know, his community organizing in the model of Alinsky?
Yeah, I think it's probably all of those things, which is why the backgrounds and the upbringing of our presidents and the people who run for office matter. I wrote a piece a couple years back for American Spectator where I said, yeah, we had this phenomenon during the Cold War called red diaper babies. And I said, we actually have arguably our first red diaper president. And you know, people on the left probably shriek at that. They're red diaper babies. I mean, there are people today who are staunch anti-communists who were red diaper babies.
These are people whose parents were communists. But you're saying this is a guy who hasn't outgrown it and who is actually applying it, it would seem, in his efforts to fundamentally transform America. This is a subject, again, we will be discussing at greater length in our next segment of this full hour devoted to the wisdom and insights of Dr. Paul Kangor of Grove City College, author most recently of 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative. More right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The apparent destruction yesterday of a civilian airliner by a surface-to-air missile, which murdered nearly 300 innocent civilians, is an outrage. The nearly simultaneous claim by a Russian separatist to have shot down a Ukrainian transport aircraft may help assign blame. While it is not easy to intercept a plane in high-altitude flight, shooting one down at lower heights is unfortunately becoming increasingly an option for enemies of the free world. That's thanks in part to the proliferation of man-portable anti-aircraft missiles after Team Obama helped jihadists overthrow Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. He had an arsenal of some 25,000 of these weapons, and many have wound up in dangerous hands. As a result, we may soon see a lot more outrages like Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. Our guest is Dr. Paul Kengor. We're doing a deep dive on the state of the war for the free world with one of the great historians of our time. He has chronicled previous chapters of it. He's extraordinarily thoughtful about the present, still unfolding chapter. And in the previous segments, we've talked a bit about the nature of the war at the moment and the presidencies that have preceded Barack Obama, in which we see some stark contrasts to his conduct. And I want to visit with you in this segment, Paul Kengor, about the school of politics, if you will, from whence Barack Obama springs. And I've mentioned your book about Frank Marshall Davis entitled The Communist, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor. I'd like to have you sort of lay out what kinds of inculcation he received from Davis in his early years and how that was reinforced by subsequent indoctrination and association with some of the country's most virulently anti-American radicals.
Yeah, sure. Well, you have a number of forces here in Barack Obama's youth. He has this grandfather, Stanley Dunham, very far to the left. He has a mother whose name also was Stanley Dunham. The mother's name was actually Stanley Ann Dunham. The mother is actually named after the father, Stanley. Mother's very far to the left. The mother and father, the Kenyan father, actually met. Now think about this, Frank. They actually met in a Russian language class at the University of Hawaii in the fall of 1960. So they're taking Russian at the University of Hawaii, not because they want to one day join the U.S. intelligence community and take on the Ruskies, right? They're genuinely interested in communism. The mother and the father were interested in communism, were completely sympathetic to Soviet communism. So you know about red diaper baby roots. I mean, here we go. Now, later on, by the end of the 60s, around 1970, the father splits. He takes off. So the mother has nobody here for Barack at home. So the grandfather introduces Barack Obama to this literal old card-carrying Communist Party member named Frank Marshall Davis. In fact, on the book you mentioned, The Communists, we reprint Frank Marshall Davis's Communist Party card number, which was 47544. And Davis had joined the Communist Party in Chicago in the 1930s and 1940s. He actually joined at some point during World War II. He became the founding editor-in-chief of the Chicago Communist Party USA publication, the Chicago Star. He does that for about 2 years. He has a number of different writers on the page who we know now actually were Soviet agents at one point. And long story short, he goes to Hawaii, and there he hooks up with and eventually mentors throughout the 1970s this young man named Barack Obama. I argue in that book that when Barack Obama went to Occidental College in 1979, and he even talks in his book, Dreams from My Father, the last person that he visited before he headed off for Occidental College, last person he went to for advice was Frank Marshall Davis. When Barack Obama went to Occidental College, I'm convinced that Obama, at that point at least, was a communist, was a Marxist. And if he did leave that extreme left, I think he didn't go a heck of a lot further to the right. I think he remained at least on the socialist left.
And there's so many others, and maybe we could just at least mention them, who were influences on his formative political thinking and present practice. And I believe that would include Cloward and Piven at Columbia, and Alinsky in Chicago, and Jeremiah Wright, and of course Bill Ayers, and Valerie Jarrett, and David Axelrod, all of whom have, you know, these sorts of qualities of virulent anti-Americanism to them. Is that overstating it?
Oh, no, it's absolutely right. And really, the troika that has Obama in the presidency today, it's Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett, and David Axelrod. Valerie Jarrett is his right-hand woman, his right-hand advisor. David Axelrod was the literal person who coined the terms hope and change. Axelrod got him elected. And I lay out in The Communists very carefully, and I assure people that there's not a shred of exaggeration in this. Barack Obama's mentor, Frank Marshall Davis, actually worked with and knew David Axelrod's mentor back in Chicago in the 1970s, the Cantor family. Valerie Jarrett's father-in-law and Valerie Jarrett's grandfather, all of these people actually literally knew each other in Chicago's Communist Party circles in the 1940s. So they all come from the same crowd. And then, yeah, after Barack Obama leaves Occidental, he goes to Columbia, where they teach Cloward Piven. Cloward Piven, they were there. Columbia is the most radical school for people who have been in and out of the Communist Party. Whitaker Chambers went into Columbia in the 1910s, went in as a Taft Republican, emerges as a communist, and ends up working for the GRU. So Obama comes from all of these radical influences.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm struck by, Paul Kengor, and again, I know you're very much in the business of trying to help train a new generation of, well, not just educated young people, but hopefully practitioners of national security policy at Grove City College. Obama has gotten away with both bringing this pedigree and seemingly acting out its radical agenda, its deconstructionist agenda of our Constitution, of our form of government, of our military strength, of our, you know, leadership in the world, and on, in part because there is not really a loyal opposition of any notable caliber that is resisting him. Again, from an historical perspective, is that overstating the problem, or do we really have a vacuum in terms of people holding him to account and resisting what he's doing at the leadership of the opposition party, the Republican Party?
Yeah, well, to some degree, that's true. And you know, the Republicans, too, I think so many people on the right, I met so many moderates in the country as well, too, are just shocked that the country would have elected somebody with this kind of background to begin with. And some people listening are probably saying, well, Kengor, what are you suggesting? Are you saying that we've elected a Manchurian candidate here who's secretly worked for the Soviets? No. But what all of this background would say about Obama is all of these people around him would have absolutely told him, look, the Russians can not only be trusted, but they should be liked, and they should possibly even be emulated.
And certainly accommodated at every turn, that's for sure.
Yeah, their ideas for the world are the right ones, and America's ideas are the wrong ones. I mean, look, Frank Marshall Davis joined Communist Party USA when Stalin was the head of the Soviet Union, during the Comintern days. I mean, they literally swore a loyalty oath to the Soviet Union to, quote, ensure the triumph of Soviet power in the United States, unquote. That's what they actually signed on to in their pledge when they joined Communist Party USA. His mother, his biological father, these people distrusted, disliked, and to some degree even detested the United States. They favored the Soviet view of the world. So Obama was raised by people of that perspective. So if today he at least accommodates Russia at the expense of U.S. policy and allies like Poland and the Czech Republic, we shouldn't be surprised by that, because that would be a natural byproduct of his upbringing.
Yeah, as would the more comprehensive effort to, as he put it, fundamentally transform the United States of America, which, as we'll talk about in our concluding segment with Paul Kengor, is proceeding apace in a whole host of areas, running notably from, you know, destroying the rule of law and our sovereignty in notably our borders, to hollowing out the armed forces of this country and our ability to project power and protect our interests. This is not an accident, comrade, as they say. More with Paul Kengor right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At America'sMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families,
including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1st, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. This is our final installment of a terrific conversation with Dr. Paul Kanger, a truly extraordinary historian and author, best-selling many times over, and notably for his most recent book, which is The 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative. We've been talking about so many issues of great import, and I'd like Paul to turn to something that you've been addressing lately. You've written a book about Hillary Clinton's faith, and you've had sort of a bit of a comeuppance, I guess, in witnessing how she has been conducting herself of late, which bespeaks a certain, well, indifference, shall we say, towards religious freedom. Talk a bit about, you know, what her wiring is, because evidently she wants to be president of the United States. She said she's looking for an office with fewer corners. I guess that's pretty much a clue, don't you think?
Yeah, Frank, I did a book a few years ago called God and Hillary Clinton, and when I'm introduced to conservative groups and they read that from my bio, there's always laughter in the crowd because the crowd thinks it's a joke. They say Paul Kengor wrote God and Ronald Reagan, God and George W. Bush, God and Hillary Clinton, and then you hear this chuckling, and the person says, no, he actually wrote a book called God and Hillary Clinton. But I did that because one of my areas is faith in the presidency and faith in politics. And in Hillary's case, she's a lifelong committed Methodist, member of the United Methodist Church. And I thought this was somebody who could be president someday, and it looks like that's still quite possible. And she's a religious left Christian, right? She's a social justice Christian. So because of that, she has some positions that would strike conservatives in particular as very unusual. But yeah, last week, or the week before, I guess, a couple weeks ago, she came out and just blasted the Hobby Lobby decision. One thing I could say about Hillary at one point, about 10 or 12 years ago, is that she, well, even 20 years ago when her husband was president, is that she seemed pretty serious about promoting religious freedom. She even co-sponsored with Rick Santorum, no less. She co-sponsored a bill on religious freedom in the workplace. But with the things that she said about the Hobby Lobby decision and some of the other things that she's doing, I don't think I can any longer count her as a great advocate of religious freedom.
Yeah. You know, what I've been struck by watching her time as Secretary of State, I think, Paul, because of the influence in her immediate personal office of a woman with extensive personal as well as family ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, namely Huma Abedin, is Hillary's attitude towards one religion in particular, namely Islam, specifically that promoted by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is nobody can give offense to Muslims, and particularly to easily offended Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood, by which has been meant really you kind of silencing of our freedom of speech, something that was the express purpose of a program Hillary Clinton was personally, directly, and actively involved with called the Istanbul Process. And I just wonder what your thoughts are as you look at her migration, shall we say, from a person who at least espoused religious freedom in the past to somebody who is not so keen on it anymore, unless it comes down to protecting the freedom of religion of these Islamists, perhaps at the expense of everybody else.
Right. No, I think that's correct. She's in this sort of classic leftist feminist conundrum where on one hand, she wants to condemn the mistreatment of women in Islamic societies, and she should, and she certainly ought to be doing that or should have been doing that as Secretary of State. But on the other hand, like so many on the left, she drifts into this accommodation of radical Islam. And so you see a Hillary kind of torn by those two things. But in the end, I think what you'd probably get from Hillary Clinton is more accommodation of radical Islam. The one thing that seems certain about Hillary is she continues to drift to the very far left. I mean, this has been a long process for her. At one point in 1964, she was a Goldwater girl. I mean, she was her daddy's Goldwater girl. And then she went to Wellesley and started moving left there. She eventually went on to Yale. Of course, she goes down south with her husband in Arkansas. And at some point, it looked like Hillary might be more of a moderate centrist Democrat, you know, maybe staying a little closer to where she had been earlier in life. But she seems to have only gone further and further to the left. And any hopes that maybe some people and that some moderate Democrats might have had that at some point a President Hillary Clinton might be an improvement from a Barack Obama and not as far to the left, I don't know. I'm seeing a more and more radical Hillary emerge here. And in 2016, I see a Hillary Clinton absolutely no semblance whatsoever of being a centrist.
Yeah, well, she will be presumably following in the model of Barack Obama and appealing to leftist primary voters. And the question is that her authentic position or is it just expediency? You know, Dinesh D'Souza, of course, in his new film about America, Imagine a World Without Her, does a marvelous job of making clear, as you mentioned, during her time at Wesley, Hillary Clinton's association with Saul Alinsky, who she dedicated and wrote her thesis about. Paul, in closing, let's just wrap all this up by talking, if you would, about knowing as intimately as anybody alive today, I think, what one of the great exemplars of a pro-American outlook and policy, namely Ronald Reagan, was all about. What would you recommend the Republicans do at this point to, you know, reconstitute, I think of it as sort of national security mindedness on the one hand, and more broadly to rebuild a real loyal opposition that can offer the American people a powerful and, I think, winning alternative to Hillary and the Obama legacy?
Well, you know, Reagan spoke of American exceptionalism. When you look up that term in the dictionary, there ought to just be a picture of Ronald Reagan right next to it. Reagan spoke of America in this very glowing, positive, not overly patriotic, jingoistic way, but a way in which he saw America as this true beacon of freedom that could be a world leader in a positive way. And that was the way Reagan said that and articulated it in the 1980s was so beautiful and so appealing that first of all, he won 44 out of 50 states against Carter in 1980, then he won 49 out of 50 in 1984. It was an amazing thing. Think about this: a conservative Republican in the 1980s twice won California, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, twice won each of those. So I think this is quite possible again, especially somebody who adapts, assuming they believe in that very positive Reagan-esque image and vision of America. I don't know who that would be on the Republican side, although I will say 2016, I think the candidates look much better than they did in 2012 and 2008. And at the very least, I think that simply by offering the polar opposite of what we've had under Obama and will have had under Obama for 8 years, that alone is a much more positive head start, and that alone would be a great improvement.
Well, I think so, too. Polar opposite, of course, rules out those who would be sort of split the difference types, Paul Kenger, the guys who would be the moderates, shall we say. It sounds as though you're saying we need a Reagan-esque individual, not simply with this sort of attachment to America, which would be so refreshing in contrast to the anti-Americans that have been running our government for the past 6 years, but also someone who's able to speak, as Reagan did so powerfully, about what it takes for it to remain an exceptional and free nation. Paul Kenger, you've done so much to teach me about these subjects. I know you're doing a superb job with your students at Grove City College and all of your readers. May their numbers continue to grow. We look forward to the next book. Congratulations again on 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative. And thank you for giving so generously of your time today.
Very kind. You're too kind.
Not kind enough. Paul, thank you. Join us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.